This is Vijay Iyer, the Vijay Iyer Sextet, Far From Over, the number one jazz recording of the year. That's according to the 2017 NPR Music Jazz Critics Poll, compiled by Francis Davis. Welcome to The Checkout. It's also a podcast on Stitcher and iTunes, and on old school radio, WBGO 88.3 FM. I'm Simon Rettner. Today we take you to the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, where WBGO's editorial director, Nate Shenan, reflects on a year in jazz. He invited a distinguished panel of journalists to speak with us about this recording and many others. Michelle Mercer from NPR, along with Giovanni Russinello from The New York Times, and Eugene Hawley Jr. from Downbeat Magazine. They pick their favorite recordings of the year, and hint, hint, I don't want to give it away, but it includes a trumpeter from Denver, a flutist from Chicago, and a pianist from Pittsburgh. Plus, our panelists remember the extraordinary Jerry Allen and how her shocking loss can guide us to thinking about women in jazz as we head to the future. And now we take you to the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. Here's WBGO's Nate Shenan.
Could I just lead a round of applause for our panel? Yeah. Eugene Hawley, Michelle Mercer, Giovanni Russinello. I'm going to start with Michelle. And I think what I'll do first, actually, is play some music from the album that you've chosen.
Start with a little story about the first time that I heard Ron Miles' music, when I heard that sound first hit me, because I think his sound distinguishes his music so much. And so it was 2002, and he had a new CD out with Bill Frisell, a duet CD called Heaven. And it arrived in the mail, and I was like, oh, Bill Frisell is on this CD. Who else? Who's this other guy? Who's Ron Miles? And so I put it on, and I remember that warm, well-rounded tone that was nothing like anything else I was hearing in New York at the time, just like hitting me straight in my heart. And so I thought, I've got to call Tom Terrell and talk to him about this, my friend Tom Terrell, fellow critic. And just then the phone rang, and Tom was like, are you listening to the new Frisell and Ron Miles CD? And I was like, yeah. And I was like, where does Ron Miles come from? And he said, Denver. And so I live in Colorado now, and I've gotten to know Ron Miles a little bit, and I wrote the liner notes for this. And so he is an educator and now largely a cornetist based in Denver. He chooses to live in Denver. And he's played with Bill Frisell and Brian Blade for years in a trio. For this album, it was special because he expanded the trio into a quintet with Jason Moran on piano and Thomas Morgan. And one thing Bill Frisell said to me was that, you know, Ron Miles' sound is so pretty that sometimes you can forget how much strength is in it. And I think you said something really beautiful today in your NPR pick of this record, Nate. You mentioned that, you know, it's not as if the beauty of his tone means there's no urgency in it. And it's also important to remember that as simple as his melodies can sound, as simple and pristine and pure in some ways, he's really applying compositional sophistication to pop and roots music. I almost kind of hear his music in terms of Colorado landscape, if I may. I have to bring a little Colorado landscape with me to New York. And so in some ways, I hear his lyricism connecting sort of his firm compositional logic on one side and then his rootsy depth on the other. And I think that's really kind of what distinguishes his music. Ron hands out the entire score to every musician. And I think Bill Frisell might do this as well, actually. And so at a Ron Miles session, you see like this huge score that's extending out beyond the edges of the music stand. And the musicians are all kind of frowning at it and looking around. And the reason he does that is because he wants everyone to feel free to compose in real time. And he also wants everyone to feel free to transcend instrumental roles. And Jason Moran said he's a guy who gives you the whole world because he wants you to play the whole world.
Well, I'll jump in just to say that this is my overall pick for Jazz Album of the Year. This is the one. Mm-hmm. And some of it for me has to do with, this was a year when I think like a lot of us, I found myself often in need of comfort. and this album, I just, put, I, like when I had a spare moment, I was like, I need to hear that Ron Miles album,
yeah.
You know? I just need to hear that you know, the contour of that composition and just the warmth, as you say, of his sound. Even in that brief clip we played, you know, you can hear how much liberties, liberties being taken by Jason Moran, by Bill Frisell. You know, they're moving a little bit, they're sort of phasing out of the, you know, the part that they're given.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, it's sort of a stealth radical record. The more you listen to it, the more you realize, like, this is as, you know, as inside and as outside as jazz gets. Gio, tell us about Mandorla Awakening, Dance of Many Hands.
Yeah, Nicole Mitchell is a great flutist, a great band leader, composer, Afrofuturist. She's somebody who came up in the Chicago scene in the 90s. What is the jazz musician's role? What is jazz's role right now, right? And I think I always find myself, especially this year, when trying to grapple with that question, one is the notion that the musicians soak up what's going on around them and speak naturally, not come out and try to like find a promontory from which to speak, right? And then the other thing I come back to is Vijay Iyer's quote, which I think is so great, which is the history of jazz is a history of community organizing.
Mm.
Which, no matter how you think about that statement, it's beautiful and it's instructive. Nicole Mitchell is somebody who's like that. She's got 8 musicians on here playing all kinds of drums and woodwind instruments, stringed instruments, taiko drum from Japan, cello. She plays the flute. You've got an Afrofuturist concept rooted in her readings of Octavia Butler, her own writings, the proceedings. And the band, crucially, is called the Black Earth Ensemble. It's kind of this ancient to the future idea to keep going back to the tropes of the ACM. They're too good not to go back to. But it's this notion that the Earth kind of, you know, it's been here a lot longer than we have, and it's going to be there long after we are gone, and that the solutions are kind of there for you to discover. So you can be a future thinker while also kind of looking at what history might be telling you. So again, that notion of we've been there before, right?
Yeah. Been there, done that.
The hang-ups that people in jazz have been dealing with for about 10 or 15 years now, where do we draw the boundary lines, how do we define what we're dealing with, they melt really easily away in most of the music that I love this year, but especially in music like this, which you really can't name what tradition she's coming out of unless you talk about where she's from. And that's why I always return to the Chicago idea, because she's from a musical lineage that said, do what you want, just, you know, listen to what's going on around you. So we have these melodies that come in and disappear. We have percussion that's, you know, thinking about Sonny Murray this week, that's hardly beat-oriented at all. Even we talk about free beats, it's not really that. It's texture, it's layers, it's wash, it's clouds, you know. And she can do that really well by making maybe the flute mingle with the percussion, so that you can't even really decide what you're listening to or what you're hearing. So I think all of that is about expanding your imagination, expanding the amount that you're able to enter into the record yourself and, as a result, enter into the creation of the record. I think a lot of other musicians, particularly ones from Chicago, were doing that this year, whether it's Roscoe Mitchell with Bells for the South Side or Jamie Branch. All those records invite you into the space that they were recorded at, and they don't make you think, oh, the studio was really well mic'd. They make you think, these musicians, like, changed the air.
So I'm going to move to Eugene's pick. We talked a bit about the history and the tradition, and this is a cool pick because this is somebody doing something that you know he knows how to do with a song that we all know. I won't say anything else. Thank you.
Ahmad Jamal.
Yeah.
Ahmad Jamal. Autumn Leaves. That's Autumn Leaves by the great Ahmad Jamal. The album is called Marseille. Is it pronounced? All right. That's my number one because for a very simple reason, this man is almost 90 years old. And I wanted people to know that there are jazz, for all the young people that are doing their thing, and that's great, we still have some jazz gods that are walking the earth, like Ahmad Jamal, like Randy Weston in their 90s, like Jimmy Heath in their 90s, like Wayne Shorter in the late 80s, you know. And I love this record because Ahmad basically has been refining his own sound since he's come out in the 1950s. I've spoken to Mr. Jamal continuously since 1989, and he always likes to stress the musical education he got in the African-American community of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He was taught by a woman named Mary Caldwell Dawson, who was had the first Afro-American opera company. He said that when he grew up, it was normal and required to know Basie and Bach. It was normal and required to know Tatum and, let's say, Horowitz. You know, it was normal. It wasn't anything you're leaving your culture behind. You know, they were encyclopedic about what they wanted to learn. You can hear Franz Liszt in Ahmad Jamal's playing. You can hear a little bit of Errol Garner in Ahmad Jamal's playing. You can hear Art Tatum, but it's all Ahmad Jamal. I mean, how many times have you heard Autumn Leaves? But he put his own stamp on it. And the thing about Ahmad Jamal, he has one of the greatest groups going out now with Herlin Riley on drums, a one-man Congo Square, you know, with Manolo Badrena from Puerto Rico, who, to call him a percussionist would be limiting. He is a percussionist colorist, you know. And what Ahmad figured out a long time ago, if you look at all his great trios, going from Vernel Fournier to Idris Muhammad, he always had a New Orleans drummer in the mix. That's what made Poinciana so deep. You know, when Vernel Fournier was putting that second line into that, the second line meeting Max Roach. So Ahmad Jamal, even though he was from Pittsburgh, he understood the music to such a degree that if I'm gonna have that, I gotta have a brother from New Orleans in there. And that's what makes Ahmad so bad.
Another topic that I wanted us to talk about, you know, I think we've all like brushed up against it this year especially, which is the issue of gender and sexism and, you know, discrimination in jazz. this is a conversation that actually in the jazz world predates the sort of explosion of the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. and precedes the Harvey Weinstein and this, you know, this current mess mm-hmm. that we see. And maybe Michelle, maybe you could start us on this because the precipitating incident is something that you wrote about mm-hmm. For NPR Music.
Mm-hmm. And so I believe it was back in March, there was something of a scandal in the jazz world. Many of you will remember this. So Robert Glasper was interviewed by Ethan Iverson for his blog, Do the Math. And in that interview, they were building rapport in the way that dudes do. And, and you know, Glasper said, I see lots of women at your gigs. And
then he gasped.
Yeah, then he gasped. You know, I think it's because you know how to groove. Like, and he ended up making this comment in which he sort of he suggested that women don't like long solos, and that they prefer groove-based music. And then he went on. That wasn't enough. He went on to suggest that in some ways he likes to sit on the groove. I believe much like a musical clitoris. Excuse me, BGO. And so it was interesting, and there was sort of a reaction on social media,
to say the least,
to a certain degree. But I think that people were critical of what he had said, but they were glad that they were able to read his thoughts. Unfortunately, I guess some people were directing criticism toward Ethan Iverson for allowing this comment to be published, which I definitely disagree with. I think it should be published. We should be able to see what musicians think. So what was interesting for me is I had always been silent on issues of gender. I had been silent for years and years. I started writing about this music in 1999, and I had never weighed in on gender issues in jazz.
Why is that?
I think in some ways, you know, we say we just want to focus on the music, and it's true, we do. We want to focus on the music. We love it, you know. I want to just sort of immerse myself in Ron Miles' sound. I don't want to think about these issues. But I also think that there was some part of me that was afraid. And so what happened was when there was this scandal online in last March, I became more afraid of not speaking up than of speaking up. And NPR asked me to weigh in on it. Robert Glasper's comments about women puts them in a particular position and denies them, first of all, I mean, the ability to listen actively, but denies them agency. And as we are thinking about how to respond to all of the sexual misconduct charges that are coming out in jazz right now, I think it's very important to think in terms of gender equality and celebrating women who are making creative music, like Nicole Mitchell, I'm sorry, and making sure that we get as many women on the bandstand as possible. But I also think it's important to sort of try to dismantle the power structure that pushes women down. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, you know, getting up on stage is one thing. Getting reviewed fairly as a woman on stage is another. What happens when you're a woman who makes music or you're a woman who writes about music? And I have to say, I'll just tell a very quick anecdote. After my Wayne Shorter biography was published in 2005, I was very disappointed because in some press materials that went out from his record label, they said that I had compiled the book. And it just broke my heart because I spent, wow, you know, 3 years reporting that book, interviewing everyone. And I felt like maybe that was perhaps a gendered reaction. They were sort of putting me into almost a secretarial role. Mm. And so they were not giving me the agency of having determined that I was going to write a particular kind of book and of following through on that, executing a plan. And so I just try to be very careful when I'm covering women to make sure that I'm giving them that agency. The agency of a creative vision and of creative execution.
So this is someone we lost this year, and I know she meant a lot to probably everyone in this room, certainly to all of us. Mm-hmm. So Jerry Allen was booked to play the Newport Jazz Festival this year with the ACS Trio, which features Terry Lynn Carrington and Esperanza Spalding. And after she passed, they announced that that slot would become a tribute with three pianists who had been influenced by her. And those pianists were Jason Moran, Vijay Iyer, and Christian Sands. And I posted that news on Twitter, and I heard from two or three guys, like, oh, why aren't there any female piano players? Well, you know, and it occurred to me in that moment, I was very puzzled by that reaction at first because I thought, oh, this is so great. Jason and Vijay, like these, there's so much love for Jerry among these musicians, you know? And it occurred to me in that moment that I had forgotten that the ACS Trio was an all-female band. And then part of me was sort of, I almost like patted myself on the back for that. I'm like, oh, well, you know, because it's just a killer band, you know? Like, it doesn't matter. and, you know, the more I thought about it, it's like, no, it's, I mean, both things can be true at once. It can be just a killer band, and it can also be very important that this is a band of all women who are dealing at this highest level. And it was interesting to me to think about the implications of that. And also the ways in which Jerry, while, you know, I think everyone will agree that Jerry Allen was just a bad musician, period, you know, she was someone who also took a lot of care to cultivate young women and to be a role model in that way. And I think it was, it's not as if being a woman in jazz was something that was on the side for her. You know what I mean? It was really at the forefront of her identity, and that was in no way a limitation on her genius, you know? What do you guys think?
You know, let me just say something about that. You know, any artist who dies in jazz, it's a loss. This loss hurts because I don't think anybody saw it coming. I knew Jerry when I was really getting into jazz, and what I loved about her background, in addition to her coming from Detroit, with all those great piano players up there, she came out of Howard University, my alma mater, an African-American institution. And sometimes we say, well, they don't really like jazz. Well, she came out of Donald Byrd's program. She also was taught by the great pianist John Malachi, who played for Billy Eckstein's bebop band. He composed a great little-known bop classic called Opus X. So Jerry came, you know, prepared. And usually when a musician's first album comes out, okay, they're getting the thing on. From the Printmakers mm-hmm. to her last album with Terry Lynn Carrington and David Mary, Jerry hit from day one, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. In an era of young lions, she was the lioness. Mm-hmm. And her death will leave a great void. And Michelle, talking about what you were talking about with the thing with Ethan, I think it came out that Ethan had never reviewed in his blog, and I love this blog, interview, yeah. right. Yeah. I don't think he never talked to a woman or whatever. And when this all went down, right, to when that whole thing went down, I'm thinking, well, you know, Jerry Allen is the greatest answer to all this about what, because there are some people, can women play jazz? You believe there's still that question is still out there, and of course the answer is yes. That question was answered with Lil Hard and Armstrong, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth asking though, because historically I've always like so we've all seen or Michelle maybe even been on women in jazz panels. Mm-hmm. Last weekend I was at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and I was in the culture section, and there was a little plaque that said women in jazz, and it was a paragraph. Mm-hmm. And it was like this little, like, okay, well, check, you know. Yeah. But the idea of this sort of thing off to the side, but at the same time, it's a space that needs to be there. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we parse that? What is the way forward mm-hmm. in this moment when we're, you know, it's like, this is a thing to be reckoned with. Like, mm-hmm. what is the best response? Well, I'm not just asking you, Michelle, but...
Well, it's an interesting moment because I think there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of discomfort. And I think that that discomfort is valuable and possibly productive because it means that social norms are shifting. I would say that historically what's worked in terms of a feminist agenda in any setting is to sort of have that woman-only space or that designated female kind of space and that effort to promote women, and then also at the same time have integration into the larger workplace. Because, I mean, that's one way that we know how well women are doing. Are they making as much money as men when they're sharing the bandstand with them, et cetera?
But is it also true that, like, does the existence of the Diva Jazz Orchestra sort of ease the pressure on the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra in a certain way?
Apparently not.
So.
No.
I don't think so. No.
I mean, no. I'm saying, like, should there be? I don't know. It's interesting to think about sort of the ways in which the division perpetuates a kind of complacency.
Well, especially when jazz is a music that is built on aesthetic affinities. Mm-hmm. You know, people play with people who they're attracted to play with. And I would hope that would cross the gender divide very often. And so, yeah, I want to make sure that I don't think that it has to be either or.
I would agree, and I would say I think, like, we've had a lot of remedial work to do, obviously, and we've been doing it, thankfully, to some degree. I think, like, the era of the all-women stuff has not closed, but it's at least started in earnest, and it's maybe it's reached its thickest point, right? Like, we already had, like, Jazz Times doesn't do an all-women issue anymore, which I know they did. Good, right?
Yeah,
and I'm glad about that. It always irked me, but it also was a good thing that they were doing it in some ways so that we could get to this point, maybe. I don't know. The Mary Lou Williams Jazz Festival in D.C. is still the Mary Lou Williams Jazz Festival, but it's not all women. Mm-hmm. And that's great, right? Yeah. That should be no surprise, but it's really good that that's happening. And that kind of stuff I've noticed happening all over the place. I think Jerry is a really good example of somebody who, if given the opportunity to speak, we learn so much just from listening to them speak. Like, Eugene, you mentioned that she comes up as a young lion or young lioness, and she's maybe, like, the only person in that era that I can think of who, like, fully had the respect of Ron Carter and
made an album of 21 with Tony Williams and Ron Carter.
Then, so she's VSOP level.
Right.
And then
and
she's...
And Black Rock Coalition, and Michelle and DeGacello. I mean, she was,
She can sound like Herbie and Cecil together, and it's just like nothing for her, right?
I will say, you know, what you were saying, Eugene, about why this one hurts. One thought I had, in the shock of her death was, like, I had been counting on her to become one of our elders, mm-hmm. like one of our 85-year-old,
right?
Exactly.
Like,
right. You know,
right?
Like, we had a lot more stuff to look forward to from her, you know.
And we had to wake ourselves up to, like, how important and how singular she was. That's the thing, is, like, the infrastructure really isn't built for celebrating a figure like her. Yeah. And I think that's why it is an important issue, sort of this kind of intersectional, complicated conversation of, like, allow spaces for women to inhabit all levels of the infrastructure, and so that they can elevate themselves, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And I actually have a question for Eugene, because I feel like a lot of the anxiety about gender issues in jazz right now has to do with racial identity having been the primary identity that we're concerning ourselves with in jazz for the longest time. And I know that Ethan Iverson, who, by the way, has, I think, made many gestures toward understanding these issues since this scandal several months ago, he said that he had never heard about intersectionality, about the idea of race and gender intersecting. Do you have anything to say about that? Like, the sort of anxiety around, I think people feel that race may be sidelined for gender if we focus too much on it.
It's not that race is sidelined. It's that we are conditioned to confront race for the last, let's say, 60 years. Mm-hmm. But sexism is much, much deeper and older and more entrenched in human behavior, going back millions of years, and only now is the scab been pulled back. And it's a learning curve, a very stiff learning curve, a very sharp learning curve, but a learning curve we all have to go through right now. I just want to say, you mentioned Mary Lou Williams. When I was at Jerry Allen's funeral, my friend Leon Lee Dorsey, a great bass player, said, you know, the parallels between Jerry Allen and Mary Lou Williams are striking, because Mary Lou Williams had Bud Powell as a student. And just think about that. Mary Lou Williams had Bud Powell as a student. And you mentioned in the tribute in Detroit, I think it's deep that they have to have, it would be like LeBron, not one, not two, but three pianists to do tribute to one person.
And there's another one coming at the Winter Jazz Fest.
Yes. Yeah. And all those people had a relationship with Jerry, because at the funerals, I won't mention the person's name, but they were kind of miffed that there were no females playing in the tribute. And I talked to Ora Harris, and these are people that had a long-standing relationship with Jerry for years. Mm-hmm. And that's what Jerry would have wanted.
One of the musicians that spoke beautifully about Jerry and has really held her up as a lodestar is Vijay Iyer. I'm going to play a bit of his album, Far From Over. That's a track called Into Action.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that cut off the best part of Grammy's entry.
Whiplash, man.
You gotta do that so people will go and buy the album.
Right.
Buy the album. This is the Vijay Iyer Sextet. Tyshawn Sorey, Vijay, Graham Haynes, Mark Shim, Steve Lehman, and Stefan Crump. You know, this album, you're seeing it pop up in a lot of non-jazz media outlets. It's, you know, I think it's on the best of lists published by Rolling Stone and Pitchfork and Stereogum and
NPR
Music. The music on this album was premiered at the 2017 Ojai Music Festival. And this is definitely one of the highlights of my year. Jazz Night in America dedicated an episode to this, so if you want to hear Christian McBride speaking words that I helped write about this, that's cool. Where to go. There's a couple things that I think make this album pop for so many of us. One of it is that, you know, Vijay's been refining a lot of ideas, especially in the realm of rhythm. There's a kind of signature that he has as a composer for small group. Things that are sort of cyclical and inspired by Carnatic rhythmic cycles, and also some of his arranging strategies, the way he works with counterpoint. And with the sextet, he has this really perfect set of materials to work with. The title of this album is was intended by Vijay to apply to struggles for justice. You know, he said, like, these struggles are far from over.
Into Action, the Vijay Iyer Sextet from his recording Far From Over on ECM. Rarely there is a consensus in the jazz world, but this year we have one. According to the 2017 NPR Music Jazz Critics Poll compiled by Francis Davis, this recording, Vijay Iyer's Far From Over, was named on 53 of 137 ballots submitted by jazz critics, including our very own WBGO's Nate Shannon and Downbeat's Eugene Hawley Jr. You can go to NPR Music to see the final results. While you're there, you'll also see another article that Nate Shannon wrote about some of the best performances he's seen this year. A special thanks to the National Jazz Museum in Harlem for allowing us to record this conversation, and to all of our panelists, Giovanni Russinello from the New York Times, Michelle Mercer from NPR, and Eugene Hawley Jr. from Downbeat. Quickly, I wanted to give a shout out to some of the other music featured in this segment. One of Jerry Allen's last recordings with the saxophonist David Murray and Terry Lynn Carrington, Jerry Allen's The Nurturer, plus a solo performance by Jerry Allen, Flying Towards the Sound, also on Motema. We also recently released a podcast with the one and only Thundercat talking about his recording Drunk. That happens to be one of my favorite recordings of 2017. And definitely keep it locked to WBGO.org for the coming year. Everyone here at WBGO is extremely excited about all of the content we will be bringing you, courtesy of our editorial director, Nate Shannon. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Simon Rettner. Thanks for checking us out.